Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy, and thank you so much for holding the fort.
Hello, and you're welcome. And more importantly, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I've had a brush with COVID, as listeners to last week's podcast will know. And although I'm still a little bit weedy and extremely snotty, I am fine.
Thank you for that.
But it's okay because we do this remotely, don't we?
Yes.
We're not
yeah,
in
yeah.
the same room. Mm. So I can tell you that I'm back, if not on my feet and not ready to run a marathon, but at least back to pottering around the garden and that sort of thing, trying to get fresh air.
Good. And that was quite a week to be, in terms of gardening, which we like to talk about all the time.
We do.
Over here, it was a week to be in the garden, sadly.
Critical jobs need doing, as you know, Lucy. I mean, it is the time of hardening off. So every day I'm sort of pottering out to the greenhouse and taking all the sweet peas out and the dahlias and this and that. No chance. It was my first thing I did when I felt I could manage a short walk, though.
Dahlias are pretty tough, except I say that, and two of mine are getting absolutely eaten every morning by slugs.
Yeah, I've got a couple like that too, and mine is still inside. So these devils are getting in from somewhere. But I'm, you know, I know our pitch to have the TLS give us our own gardening podcast may have been, you know, set back a bit by last week, but I think we're back on full force now. What are you happiest at the moment with in your garden?
Happiest and slightly surprised by the roses, because my roses are now coming out before the peonies. Isn't that weird?
I mean, peony is a law unto itself under all circumstances, but do they look lovely?
They're amazing. They've gone nuts. There's something about this spring that they have very much enjoyed. So yeah, they're huge.
I'm exceptionally envious. I like to think that at the top of this hill here in Southern Ireland, we're always a little bit behind, although I will say my potatoes are going great guns. So
we should.
You say that pride goes before a fall when the crows see that. I don't know about you. I've started to see my first swallows and swifts, though.
No, and I'm very jealous of that. That's really wonderful, actually.
It's a lovely moment, even when you are palely coughing on your bed and you just see one out of the window and you think, yes, spring has come. Anyway, before we get closed down or hijacking this podcast, we will tell you what's coming up on the show. This week, we delve into the remembrance of things past as Mary Beard tells us all about the souvenir buying habits of ancient Rome. It turns out we are not the only people to come back with a little memento in our suitcases. And Edward Docks will be here to discuss whether there's any way back for a parliament mired in shame, scandal, and contempt.
But first, the summer is nearly upon us, and many people's thoughts will turn to holidays and travel. And if you do go on holiday somewhere, you might bring something back. A t-shirt, a figurine, a reminder of the beauties of your trip, or just a fun thing. Lots of people do, of course, and it turns out we've been doing this for centuries. Our own classics editor, Mary Beard, has reviewed two new books on the subject of ancient souvenirs, and she's here with us now, wearing her Kiss Me Quick hat, I imagine, and she's going to guide us through the Styx of Rock and the Venus de Milo statuettes. Mary, thank you for joining us. I'm sorry for revealing to the world that you're wearing your Kiss Me Quick hat.
I know, it looks great. I look great in it.
Definitely. So you start your piece by telling us about a trip that Hadrian took in 130 BCE. What was he going to see and how do we know about that trip?
This journey by Hadrian is one of my kind of favourite moments in ancient history of all time, really, because Hadrian was the greatest travelling emperor. You know, unlike others, some of whom just stayed in Rome, basically, Hadrian went sightseeing, not just, you know, he didn't just go to fight the barbarians, he went sightseeing. And his most famous sightseeing episode is when he goes to what the city we now call Luxor in Egypt to see the great colossal statues, which were already 1,000 years old by the time he got there, great pharaonic statues. Now, there are all kinds of things which are kind of odd about this trip, because Hadrian goes to see these statues just after he's lost his beloved boyfriend in the Nile, a mysterious case of drowning. And so you imagine that the atmosphere in the imperial party was not as joyous as it might have been. But what they were going to is one of the most famous tourist sites ever in the ancient world, to see these colossal statues. And it was not just because they were colossal that they were famous. It was that one of them was supposed to sing to you if you were lucky. We don't quite know how this worked, or we don't quite know whether it wasn't a trick by some good entrepreneurs in ancient Luxor. But if you went at dawn, it made a kind of whistling singing noise. And that was what you went to see. It was a miraculous statue. And we know that Hadrian went one morning and the damn statue didn't sing. So they had to go back the next day and it did sing. Now, why we know about this, though, is even in some ways more interesting. It's because one of the ladies in Hadrian's party, a woman called Julia Balbilla, composed some poetry about this occasion, about the failure of the statue to sing on day one, but the successful singing on day two. And she actually had someone carve it into the leg of the statue itself. So, a bit of vandalism. And heavens, she was not the only one, because one of the things that you did if you went to see this statue was you left your mark on it. And there's sort of 100 or so carvings, you know, a kind of Kilroy was here sort of moment on the leg and body of the statue, where people say, I came and I heard it, or it worked for me. And so you've got that kind of, I think it's a sort of exciting direct connection with the past, you know, because, you know, I've been to see these statues and there, I look at it and it's, you know, an old pharaonic statue, but there on its leg is this lady who visited it in 130.
And you can still clearly see that and read it.
And you can still see it and read it. You know, it is exciting. Mm.
Suppose one of the things that tells you, obviously, is that there weren't sort of tourist sites in that, because there wasn't tourism. So, I mean, your first thought is, well, you'd never be able to carve something on the leg of a statue now, because it would be, you know, behind ropes. I mean, you know, you couldn't get anywhere near it, could you?
You'd end up in the nick, I think.
Exactly. There was a more sort of, I suppose, being the emperor, you know, helps, obviously. But there was a more sort of direct physical sort of interaction between things that people visited.
And I think that's important. And that I think is what's very in your face when you look at this, because the emperor obviously has and the emperor's party, you know, get a bit more free rein than other people. But, you know, loads of people, there are other women, the governor of Egypt's wife, you know, this kind of thing. They've also left their mark. And, you know, I couldn't, you know, because of my job professionally, I couldn't possibly recommend that people tried to do this anyway themselves, because they would, of course, get into trouble. But I think there is something sort of nice about that memorialization of your presence at a monument. I suppose now we do it with selfies, don't we? I mean, the selfie, which everybody says, oh, gosh, you know, how tedious they, you know, people only come to this monument. And what do? They take a picture of themselves on their phones, you know. And I think that's you know, that's kind of important. You know, we when we go to these tourist sites, we want to kind of memorialise our visit there, and we do it in different ways. So I think the selfie is, you know, it's quite an important bit of modern touristic culture.
Well, you heard it here first. No, I'm sure that is it. I'm sure that is true, that people, it's a very human thing to want to do, to say, look, I really was here. It really did happen, and I can look back on it.
I was really there. And I think that's, you know, I think we should be a bit more tolerant of that. You know, you look, you go to the Louvre and you look at endless people having, you know, doing selfies in front of the Mona Lisa, and you, you know, you do think, oh, how irritating, I want to see this painting, whatever. But actually, you know, they're doing what Hadrian's Party did in 130. They're kind of, they're marking their presence, they're remembering it. It's souvenir, you know, to remember it.
Yeah, yeah.
Mary, I must say, about to go completely off track here, but we encourage digression, don't we, on this podcast, Lucy?
Yes, she said, with trepidation.
It puts me in mind of many years ago, my husband was covering the World Cup in Germany, and his duties took him to Nuremberg, and he was sort of walking around looking at it before there was a match there, and looking at this, you know, absurd monument to fascism. And he saw that somebody had written the word Cypress Hill on one of the seats, and Cypress Hill, an American black rap band. And he thought how much Hitler would have hated that. And so that this moment of sort of, I was here,
yeah,
is sometimes very, very, it really kind of juxtaposes past and present in a way that's actually very satisfying, yeah, sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, quite pleasing.
Yeah, and quite constructive, actually. You know, and I, yes, I think that in some ways, you know, if we think about our own current statue wars, you know, maybe a bit more constructive graffiti, you know, might be one way of engaging and showing our disapproval, if you like, of some of these people who stand in public places around us. You know, don't just have to take them down. In some ways, you can actually kind of, you can pull them down to size in cleverer ways.
Mm.
And graffiti, I think, is one of the ways we do that, and always have.
So the Julia Balbilla did her graffiti, or got someone else to, as you say.
Imagine that she kind of hitched up her skirt, climbed up, and, you know, with her tools. I don't think that's very likely. I think she probably paid quite a hefty sum to have a local craftsman immortalise her verses on the statue. Yeah.
Hadrian also, he commemorated his trips, didn't he? You said he was a great sightseer. In his villa at Tivoli, which was actually a kind of great big sort of encampment, wasn't it? A great big area. How did he commemorate them? Tell us about his villa.
Well, I think the villa is very interesting. People now kind of take Hadrian's villa at Tivoli, you know, a bit for granted. In fact, as you say, it's the size of a town. Hadrian built this extraordinary city for himself, you know, a few miles outside Rome. But what is very special about it, apart from all its little kind of bits of luxury and its underground car park and things like that, underground chariot park.
Chariot park, brilliant.
One of the things he did was he replicated bits of his empire in inverted commas, in his villa. So he recreated the famous temple where the statue of the Aphrodite of Cnidos stood. He recreated Egyptian monuments. He had the Caryatids from the Athenian Acropolis displayed in front of him in his villa, as if somehow what he was doing was creating a microcosm of empire through its cultural highlights at this extraordinary country theme park, really, I suppose, is what it was.
It's an amazing idea. It makes it sound like Las Vegas, yeah, got the Eiffel Tower and the pyramids and, yeah, and all of that.
Yeah.
And everyone says, how awful. But actually, it's a kind of amazing thing to do.
Yes, you know, it is. You know, I think there must probably have been some people in the second century CE who thought how naff this is when they saw what Hadrian had done. But in some ways it is, you know, it's another way of memorialising. It's a way of, you know, you ask yourself the question of how do I fit into this world? How do I see it? How do I imagine it when I'm not there? And you know, one of the ways to do that, if you've got the money that Hadrian had, is, of course, to rebuild it. And, you know, there's a long tradition of that, too. You know, within Christian architecture in the Middle Ages, you know, there are people rebuilding the Holy Sepulchre in their local church. It's about making visible things that you want to remember. And I think we should knock it a bit less than we usually do.
I mean, we see it even now, don't we? See it at something like the cast courts at the Victoria and Albert Museum, where you can go and see Trajan's column and all that. I mean, it's obviously a tradition that hasn't entirely sort of died out, even kind of museum sort of circles.
I think absolutely. And you know, the cast courts, I mean, they were, you know, for a while, terribly unfashionable in the mid-20th century. You know, people thought, oh, you know, plaster casts, you know, how dreary, you know, plaster casts of Trajan's column, really. I think one of the sort of side benefits of postmodernism, in a way, has been that we've started to think about replicas and reproductions and imitations in a way that's a bit more generous to them.
I've always found them really mesmerising, actually. Mm. And partly that's because you stand next to them all together and you think, I'm in a room of these huge plaster casts. Why? And they have this kind of sort of power of being all together, I suppose.
And also you experience them in a whole range of very different ways from the way you experience the original. It wasn't until I went quite recently that I realised you could actually sit in the bottom of Trajan's column. No, you could go inside it. It was sort of hollow. And so it gives you a different way of engaging with objects that somehow you think were just the same. You know, they are replicas, but they're doing something different to you. And, you know, I think that's like my ouzo bottle that I bought in Plucker several years ago, full of not very nice ouzo, but in the shape of the Venus de Milo, you know, and I have Venus de Milo on my mantelpiece. That's both about admiration. It's about cutting her down to size. It's about a joke, you know, because it's an ouzo bottle, and it's about ownership. And I think the culture of those kind of memories, whether we call them souvenirs or not, is I think very interesting about what it says about us and how we want to engage with the places that we go.
So, as you say, Hadrian was able to do it by basically recreating it because, as you say, it was his empire and he had all the money. But you said also that so-called ordinary people did travel around a fair bit. People got around the empire, didn't they? So what did they bring back if they didn't have what was their equivalent of the Venus de Milo statuette with ouzo in?
Yes, well, they couldn't quite do what Hadrian did, and I don't think that very many people, except the very rich in the ancient world, went on holiday. But they did travel. The Romans are much more mobile than we think, and when they went places, they also wanted to remember. They probably were going for work or whatever, but they wanted to remember. And they bought, it looks like, the sorts of things that we buy. There is a wonderful glass bottle in the shape of a famous statue from Antioch, the so-called Good Fortune Tyche of Antioch. Probably originally filled with perfume or maybe the ancient equivalent of ouzo. And there's something terribly similar to my ouzo bottle, you know, that I'm going to this city and I've seen its famous statue, and yet I'm bringing it back in a different form. I'm bringing it back, you know, filled with something in glass. And one of the things that I think people aren't very well aware of, partly because they don't often get put on, you know, spotlit display in museums, often kind of crappy little things. But there are endless miniature replicas of some of the most famous works of art in antiquity. I mean, the statue of Athena that was inside the Parthenon, you know, you can find plenty of her in, you know, in cheap terracotta and or on little cheap gems. And you know, they're into the same mechanisms of recall and ownership and souvenir, and no doubt partly present and gift that we are.
And also, I guess, telling somebody that you've been there.
Mm.
You know, you're displaying something to say, yes, of course I've been there, haven't you?
Yes, that's right. And of course, it's because in the ancient world, we don't know the history of these objects when we find them. So we're never quite sure whether the person who owned this little terracotta Athena, whether they'd been to Athens, or whether actually it was a sort of, it was a symbol that substituted for a visit. I mean, there are plenty of people, you know, who have postcards or posters on their wall, I do, of works of art that we've never actually seen. So they fulfill quite complicated, ambivalent relationship between the experience of viewing or the desire to view or the parade of a particular, you know, cultural cachet, I guess. It's no doubt it was as complicated in the ancient world as it was now.
There are disciplines, aren't there? You mentioned there are disciplines that study this kind of thing, kind of now, as it were, souvenir theory and theories of place. So can these help in figuring out what the Romans did with the objects and what they meant to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think they can. And I think that anyone who tried to look at ancient souvenirs as what clearly some of these objects are, you know, I think, you know, would be very foolish to do it without thinking about how modern sociologists have discussed souvenirs. I mean, the problem, as always, with the ancient world is quite how similar is it? Quite how, you know, is this an identical experience? Is it partly overlapping, but partly very different? And there's one particular group of objects that both the writers in the books I discuss talk about, which are extraordinary, rather beautiful glass flasks with the cityscape of the towns of Baiae and Puteoli from the Bay of Naples. Roman, they look like Roman souvenirs. They look like, you know, I've been to Baiae and I've gone home with a glass flask with the seafront of Baiae scratched out on it. Where you can, and it's not always easy, but you then look at where these things were found, and several of the ones we know were found in graves. And you think, okay, this is a souvenir, but I don't get buried with my ouzo bottle. Are these things doing something very different in the ancient world from what our souvenirs do? Maybe they are. You can't quite tell that they are fulfilling the same function.
There's always a danger, as you say, isn't there, because we recognise the object, there's a danger to leap to it and go, well, they're doing what we do.
That's right. And in part, maybe they were, but in part, maybe these are fitting into the kind of culture of the ancient world in a significantly different way. Now, I can't begin to think what the connection between a glass flask with the cityscape of Baiae on it and the rituals of death, but it looks as if there was one in a way that there isn't now.
Is it so widespread that, I mean, you know, sometimes people are buried with favourite objects. I mean, could it be that sort of simple, or is it too widespread? Does it happen too frequently for that to be likely?
We're dealing with quite a small sample. let me be honest, it's very hard to know. And you know, you can say, look, this is very precious to somebody. What do you do with burials? You can't get buried with something very precious to you. And it's as simple as that. Some of the inscriptions that are also on them, there's the kind of the cityscape is engraved, but then his little messages are engraved, also look a bit like funerary things, you know, the memory of my bright light and this kind of thing. So I think it's puzzling. But my favourite example, though, actually, is one where I think for once we can actually be pretty certain that we're dealing with something which is absolutely spot on our experience. Because a few years ago, there was a metal stylus for writing discovered in Roman London. And it's got a kind of very, very tiny, difficult to read verse on it. But as far as you can decode it, and I think this is fairly certain, it does actually say, I went to the big city and all I brought you was this rotten pen. Partly, we are in the same world. Now, I think at the margins, we might not be.
That's perfect, isn't it? It's wonderful to find something like that and go, there, see, you show it to someone and say, look, that present wasn't so bad.
They were like us, after all.
We can think that we're part of a long and noble tradition, beginning with at least Hadrian.
Yes, no need to feel ashamed.
You've made me feel so much better about my goldfinch fridge magnet, I must say.
Oh, yeah, I'm a big fan of all these things.
The Romans would have so liked the fridge magnet, I think.
Both beautiful and useful for holding up your shopping list.
They'd also quite like a selfie, I can't help but imagine. You know, if only Hadrian had his smartphone.
You'd be sifting through them even now, Mary. That's what you'd be doing. Thank you very much for enlightening us and liberating us from any lingering shame we may have felt about our knickknacks. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, is Partygate a storm in a teacup or the manifestation of a government that knows no shame? Edward Dox will be here to ponder the ills of Westminster. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
To the TLS podcast with me, Alex Clark, and the TLS arts editor, Lucy Dallas.
Now, in recent weeks and months, Boris Johnson's government has lurched from one crisis to the next, from lobbying scandals to Russian donors, from lockdown parties to the heavy defeats of the local elections. But where did it all start? Are these missteps caused by poor judgment and blinkered political vanity, or are they indicative of a much more deeply rooted rot? The title of Hannah White's book, Held in Contempt, may give you a clue as to where she stands. Edward Dox has reviewed it and joins us now. Welcome, Edward.
Hello.
Now, I have to say, your review, one of the angriest I've ever read, and all the better for it, didn't leave me in very much doubt as to where you stand. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I mean, hasten to add, not at all angry with Hannah White's book, which was and is excellent, and which I read with a sense of great relief that there was another sane person out there who documented what had happened in Parliament, well, really since 2016. But the subject which she addresses in a different way, I think, to the way I address it, which is the subject of contempt. Sure, I'm pretty cross about that, and in particular, cross about it with relation to Johnson and the current government.
I mean, just tell us a little bit about the scope of her book. What's interesting, as you point out, is that she was once a clerk of the House of Commons. Now she's deputy director of the Institute for Government. So she really knows whereof she speaks.
I think Hannah White is one of those wonderful, wonderful British people who began their adult lives deeply devoted to making things better in the way that lots of civil servants are, but in her case, in Parliament. Mm. And she later advised on committees and has vast parliamentary experience in the most close-up and day-to-day dealing with MPs, dealing with legislation, dealing with procedures kind of a way. I don't know exactly when she left for the Institute for Government, but I think it was in the last 5 years. And she moved from being inside the House and literally, you know, talking to MPs about how to get legislation passed or what works, what doesn't work and what's legal and what's not legal. She moved from that to a more wider strategic role where she now looks at, well, it's the Institute for Government, so looks at government. And from a non-party political point of view, she was non-party political when she was in Parliament, of course, as well, tries to assess what might be done to make, you know, the central engine of British life, i.e. the procedures of Parliament, work better. And so that's where she comes from. And her book really is a, as you might imagine, given that background, a wonderfully skillful and forensic look at various aspects of Parliament, done from a vantage point of expertise and with lots of love. She obviously, as many civil servants do when you get to read their stuff or get to know them, she obviously loves Britain and loves Parliament. So it's written from a place of great care, I think. But she essentially diagnoses what we might say is, well, she calls it in her title, Held in Contempt. And she looks at various aspects of political life and how that plays out in Parliament and goes through them and sort of illuminates for the reader what it is that's going wrong. And just to give you some examples, one would be the arcane procedures are so difficult to learn that many young MPs or new MPs have no idea how anything works. And it takes them a long time to do so. You arrive in Parliament, perhaps with lots of excitement and vim and, you know, from either side, whatever your views, trying to get things done for your constituents. And you sort of hit this labyrinthine nightmare of how procedure works and get ground down by it, or it takes too long. Second obvious point she makes is the building, the actual buildings and fabric of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, Palace of Westminster, is really, really dilapidated. And I used to work there briefly as a journalist myself, and I can tell you there's mice everywhere. You know, all the heating pipes leak. It's old and it's falling apart, and the disrepair is just such an obvious metaphor, really. And then the last thing, and I think the most serious, although all of those things are serious, is the way that successive governments, because of Brexit, have started to treat Parliament, starting off with Theresa May, who had to be reminded by the Supreme Court that she couldn't behave in the way she's trying to behave. And then we move on to the very, very, I can't think of a better word than bad, approach that Boris Johnson has had to Parliament, where he repeatedly sidelines Parliament, tried to prorogue Parliament, turned the people against Parliament by calling the Brexit bill a surrender bill. So essentially made the country complicit in discussing the illegitimacy of Parliament, and then goes on from there, you know, and now is stands accused of repeatedly lying to Parliament. And Hannah makes that case. And then I go on from there to talk more generally and perhaps more on the emotional human side of what contempt means.
The first thing that one thinks, of course, is those processes and procedures, which Hannah White seems to say, and you to agree, are just render Parliament not fit for purpose in the modern world. Of course, they apply whatever party is in government. But it also seems that you're making the point that there has been an incredible manipulation of those weaknesses in the last few years, that essentially, Theresa May and then Johnson after her have used to manipulate to their own ends. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, one of the things that came home to me reading Hannah White's book is a lot of what's actually happening in Parliament is driven by those parliamentarians who have been there for quite a while and who've somehow got a grip on the arcane procedures and the labyrinthine difficulties of how you pass secondary and primary legislation and how you amend a vote and so on and so on. And this is not always the case, but it's often the case. Instead of discussing the matter in hand, members are constantly introducing bills or amendments that the public just don't understand. So the public are thinking, should we leave the European Union or not? And the parliamentarians may be thinking about that, but their bills don't seem to reflect that. Although they do in terms of the narrow parliamentary procedures. Very few people followed, for example, probably the most important act, or one of the most important acts of recent times, the Benn Act, and then following that onto the European Acts in the autumn of 2019. So when we're looking at those things from the outside, we're not, as people, we're not understanding very clearly what's going on. And nor, Hannah White makes the point, are the younger MPs. Now, you add that to another point that she makes, which I think is very good, which is this problem of parliamentary exceptionalism, whereby MPs feel, and in some ways you can see why, that's their legitimacy, that's the reason they're there. And they need not participate in the kind of human resources type life that someone in business would be. So, you know, if in business you had someone said you'd assaulted them or whatever, there would be procedures, it would be quite clear, there'd be tribunals and so on and so on and so on. In Parliament, as we all know, there are, I think, over a dozen live cases of that as we speak. And then there's all the stuff about Owen Paterson and lobbying, and there's all kinds of areas where MPs behave as if they're exceptions to established rules. And that reaches its apogee in the figure of Johnson. I don't think I'm saying anything out of line here, but who essentially does what he pleases and then finds a way to get away with it in front of Parliament, rather than, as Hannah White argues at the end of her book, setting an example where MPs become exemplars. They become the best of us. So they try their best to be great equal rights for fathers and for mothers and all the good things and all the future things that are coming anyway, rather than try to do that and have great human resources procedures and fairness and no bullying. And they do it the other way around. They do all the things they can get away with, or they seem to do all the things they can get away with to the public. So she's really making a case for the dereliction of Parliament. And I then go on to make my point off the back of hers, which is I think that this dereliction reaches its kind of, nadir is a better word than apogee here, reaches its nadir in the figure of Johnson, who I think is himself personally full of contempt, not just for Parliament, but I also think for the media, I think for his own party, and I also think for the country.
There's a balance, isn't there, between, because from what you say and what seems evident, there's a lot of need for reform of the arcane procedures, as you say, to put some HR in, to make it to make it much more modern and straightforward and fit for purpose. And then from what we can see, Dominic Cummings, one of his, I think, stated aims, it was sort of beyond reform. Is it that was kind of, it seems to me that was kind of destruction of what was there, or almost shoving it aside. And the danger of it is, you know, and maybe if you did get rid of it all, you would get rid of a lot of bad things, but then there's nothing there. So I'm saying that there is reform needed. Dominic Cummings, let's say, comes along and says, okay, I'll reform it. But what actually he does is make it seem unimportant, which is exactly the opposite of what Hannah White wants. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think Hannah White and Dominic Cummings are very good ends of spectrum. I mean, in my view, I think it's a different subject, but I think Cummings' apocalyptic worldview and the kind of, in my view, the emotional hysteria with which he's a funny writer, because for all his claims of rationalism and altruism and clarity, he actually writes some of the most emotionally hysterical prose that you can read in modern Britain.
I'm really glad you say that, Edward, because I read some of the things and I sometimes think, is it me? I cannot make head nor tail of them half the time.
It's all at force 10. It's actually the opposite of rational. It's actually, you know, I mean, there's another piece to write about that, but it's actually, in my view, the opposite of rational. It's a kind of, it's a rationalism that is used as a thin carapace to cloak a soul on fire. I mean, the guy is completely on fire. And I strongly disagree with everything that he has stood for. But I do think one thing he shares with Hannah White, and which I think we have to grant him, is he is interested, however wrongly, in my view, in the better polity of the UK, which I think distinguishes both Hannah White and Dominic Cummings from Johnson, because Johnson is not interested in those things. Johnson is essentially, in my view, I wrote a long piece a while ago, I think a year ago, saying that I think he was very close to an archetypal clown. And in this piece that I write in the TLS, I indicate how I think he uses absurdism as a weapon, and the theatre of the absurd, and how he collapses moral compass. It's a sophisticated attack on the polity and on Parliament and on Britain. But it is nonetheless a corrosive and diminishing attack, whereas I think both Hannah White, certainly Hannah White, but I think Cummings in his way, although misguided, and I blame him for lying to the country about Brexit and so on, although misguided and wrong, they are at least interested in the discussion. We could have them on to this podcast and we would at least agree the aim being how do we make Britain better, even if we disagreed the means. Whereas I think the Prime Minister is a completely, he's a very interesting character and a character, I think, who adorns national life. He just shouldn't be Prime Minister. He's the worst possible character for Prime Minister.
This is the real crux of the review and what I find so fascinating. Mm. You mentioned there, you talk about the theatre of the absurd, and you also talk about the psychology and the psychiatry. You know, I didn't particularly expect to be reading about D.W. Winnicott in this review, but I was very glad I did. But you talk about his creation of a false self.
That's right.
And it's really fascinating when you begin to think, okay, there's somebody in charge who is operating in a kind of, I don't know, sort of shadow kind of way. I mean, what we think he's doing is not really what he's doing.
Let me just show how the piece gets there. So what I was thinking when I was writing this, I was writing, so if you like, Hannah White is concerned with the parliamentary and the factual side of contempt. And I'm interested in the moral psychology of contempt and what it teaches us about people. And one of the things that I was reading was a very good essay called Above and Beneath Contempt by a guy called Professor David Sussman. And he includes this fascinating quote from Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil. And I'll just give you the quote. He who despises himself still esteems himself as one who despises. And I write in the piece, I think that's a very striking quote because it captures something that the public feel instinctively about Johnson. And that's that there's a Johnson looking down on Johnson who can't believe that Johnson is getting away with Johnson, if you see what I mean. There's, as it were, two simultaneously present Johnsons. We might call one Boris and one Johnson, if you like. I never dispute that he's a clever guy. He's a very clever guy. But what's happening here, it seems to me, is that when you see Johnson in an interview or when he's questioned or even when he's talking, there's the character of Boris and then there's the slightly more sage, insightful and indeed interesting man. His family call him Alexander Johnson. And these two people kind of coexist simultaneously. And that's where we get to Winnicott's idea of the false self and the authentic self. And in a nutshell, Winnicott's idea is that in childhood, to counter coldness around us or disinterest around us, we develop a false self. And everyone does it to a certain extent. I certainly have a false self. But in extreme circumstances, this false self becomes monstrously distended and sophisticated and an incredible performance, if you like. And that performance does really well because it's designed to seduce and beguile and garner attention and do all the things that were not there before. So if you like, under Winnicott's theory and people who are interested in reading more Winnicott, I love his writing. He's very, I'm just trying to remember the name of the exact book. It's called Playing in Reality, and it was written in 1971, very germane when it comes to Johnson. Anyway, there we are. We've got this idea of a false self and a true self. Now, what happens, Winnicott argues, when this gap gets really, really big, as I would say it is in the case of, say, Johnson, I think Rees-Mogg's another candidate. What happens in the gap between the false self and the authentic self is that all kinds of uncomfortable feelings germinate. Guilt, shame, horror, embarrassment, furtiveness, phoniness, and of course the fear of discovery. Because you're pretending. It's a protracted masquerade, is one of Winnicott's phrases. So what I think happens in the case of Johnson is one way that he gets out of these feelings, and the reason people think he's shameless and people think he doesn't suffer any guilt, is that he uses the absurd. He has this view, which is common among very highly educated people, I think, that the world is absurd, that we've made up the laws, that we've made up morality, we've made up gods, we've made up everything that we do. And that's an absurd thing to have done. And Johnson thinks things are absurd. If you read his novel, not a novel I recommend, just as a way of finding more out about him, He says it. He says his character, who is called Roger Barlow, of all characters' names, says all this. And so Johnson uses the absurd and the fact that he thinks everything's absurd and invites you to agree to collapse these feelings of discomfort, these feelings of guilt and shame. If people are all absurdly constructed, then he doesn't need to feel any anxiety of self-contempt. Now, of course, the problem with that is, again, all very interesting if you've got your own show on TV or if you're a brilliant novelist or if you're an entertainer of some sort. It's no good in a prime minister because absurdism corrodes the very fundamental things that we need to function as a polity. So that being parliament, that being truth, that being the duty of honesty, that being all the things that we need to make our country work. And actually Johnson's wrong because people like me agree. Of course we make the laws up and of course we invent philosophy and science and nation states and courtroom procedure and so on and so on. We know that, but the reason we invent them is to give our lives meaning. So I think that's why Johnson, in my personal view, this is my view really, but I think that's why Johnson is so deleterious to the polity and, you know, to all the Irish people who on both sides of that discussion who are suffering from his lack of, you know, he basically treats borders as absurd. He treats countries as absurd. He treats religions as absurd. You know, and then the Scottish fishermen who are out of business and all the Brexit stuff. So, and all the Conservatives, some friends of mine, very well-meaning, brilliant Conservative MPs, people like David Gawk, who got booted out. I disagree with them politically, but I can see that he wants to try and make things better. So even they don't like Johnson because Johnson basically treats the Conservative Party as absurd as well.
Thinking about the people he surrounds himself with, his cabinet first and foremost, but his other political allies, are they all just still going along with this for their own reasons of self-advancement and perhaps the kind of survival of the Conservative Party? I mean, people may not analyse Johnson to quite the degree that you have done. I'm not sure his cabinet, for example, is sitting around reading Winnicott and Nietzsche, but they must still have a sense of this. Why is it then that they tolerate it?
Because he wins them elections, because he's a performer.
Well, there we go. There's two answers. First is because he wins. So that just leave that there. That's why I think the letters have not gone in. Second answer, I think, I'm not alone in this. Many, many better writers and thinkers than me have written it, that he surrounds himself by people who are not his intellectual and instinctive equals. Those kind of people, and I'm thinking now of people like David Gawk or Nick Bowles or, you know, Oliver Letwin or famously smart Conservatives, cannot be anywhere near his government. The people that are close to him and that surround him in Parliament are people who are, you know, not got his intellectual ability and people who don't think and challenge him or would never think to challenge him in this way. And I think he's hollowed out the Conservative Party.
The Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Julian Smith, was one such person, I think, and was widely admired on this island. Mm. And of course, therefore had to go.
Yeah. So that's what happens. The people, you know, people like Priti Patel and Nadine Dorris owe their careers and their positions to him quite clearly. And the minute he goes, they go. And they know that. I don't think that there are, you know, there are many people in the cabinet. In fact, I mean, Michael Gove is obviously highly intelligent, but Gove is a busted flush now, I think. And he's not allowed near the media. So I think that most of the people around Johnson, I like Guido Harry. I've sat next to him at dinner a couple of times, but he's there for the fun. He's not there to tell Johnson what to do, really. Steve Barclay owes his position to him. I don't think Steve Barclay's a particularly profound guy either. So the people around him are not the great Conservatives of our generation. He's deracinated the people around him and put sycophants and less able people in there. And I think the Conservative Party is in big trouble because I think that the country is really, really sick of them now. And lots of people on the centre right, people who have maybe voted for Blair, might even have voted for Brown, but then went back to Cameron and Clegg, they've had enough. And I think the Liberal Democrats are going to do very well in the South, better than people think. And I think it's going to be, you know, the Conservatives will find themselves having to start again. I think the damage he's doing, when I say in the piece, the damage he's done to the UK is absolutely unbelievable. I mean, it's really, really, really deleterious to our standing in the world and to the polity of our country.
I was just wanted to just say something about the theatrical side of it, because in terms of the performance, because as you say, they're all doing a performance because they're public figures, and to being a clown and being in the theatre of the absurd, everything is absurd, but the clown can be trying to create meaning within that. They do also show you behind the scenes, as it were, but you can in that sense have creative clowns rather than destructive clowns. But from the way you're saying it, that's not even what he is he?
No, I mean, I agree with that, and I think that's a really good point. And I think that you're right, the theatre of the absurd is partly about the illumination of the architecture of theatre, and therefore the architecture of human society, thinking and relationships. It's not that I think that Johnson isn't doing that. I think he is doing that all the time. If you watch him in an interview, he basically is saying, my God, these interviews are so ridiculous. Can you believe that a person thinks this is the way to get the truth? Are you watching this? This is ludicrous. He's asking me a silly question. And I'm going to give him a silly answer, because what answer else can I give him? This is such an absurd way to run things. So he's transmitting that all the time. And I think that's why I say in another piece that he's an archetypal or instinctive or compulsive clown. It's not that I don't think that those things are worth doing. I just think that it's the worst possible characteristic to have as a prime minister. Because the prime minister has to be someone who upholds the polity and says, however we've arrived at these decisions, however we've arrived at this parliament, this way that we run things, we need to continue to believe in these things seriously, because this is how, as a nation, with a degree of communion and reciprocity, we live. It can't be someone who's saying the ideas of communion and reciprocity are absurd. Do you not realize life is about appetite? Look at me. I've got to go and sleep with someone else. I've got to eat more cake. You can't have someone like that in the center of things, or else everything falls apart. And I think we're seeing that. We're seeing that. I mean, everything he turns towards, he treats as an apex clown. And it's funny and it's interesting. It is funny. It's interesting. It's also very involving, and voters fall for it. You're drawn into it. But it's also just not what you need in a leader. If I was in charge of things, he'd be the culture secretary or something. And he'd be brilliant at that. But I wouldn't make him foreign secretary, and I wouldn't make him prime minister, and I wouldn't let him anywhere near anything serious.
Culture is serious, can I just say, on the TLS podcast? Culture is serious.
Yes, sorry. Of course, as a novelist, I believe culture is serious. But I mean that culture is playful and thoughtful as well as earnest.
Yes.
It might play to his strengths a little bit more.
Yeah.
I have to say, Edward, as you say, you're a novelist, and I think you have your next subject.
Yes, I've been thinking about that. But then you think, do you really want to sit in the mental space of Johnson's clowning? I probably will, but not next. I'm in the middle of one at the moment, so I'm gonna get to the end of that. But I, you know, his teachers, everyone says he's very interesting, and I think he is very interesting. I just think he shouldn't be prime minister.
Thank you so much for coming on the TLS podcast. We're very grateful.
My great pleasure.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Mary Beard and Edward Docks. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.